So I've got something exciting to share. My book, What Are You Thirsty For? Rethinking Alcohol and the Life You Want, is now available for pre-order. It's about rethinking your drinking, not because you necessarily have to, but because deep down you know there's more waiting on the other side. It's about creating space for clarity, for calm, and the version of you that doesn't need alcohol to cope. So if you're looking for a refreshing take on alcohol identity and desire, just tap the link in the show notes and pre-order. Right, let's get on with the episode. Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink podcast with me, your host, Anna Donaghy. If you've noticed that the drinking culture in the UK is changing and you're curious about why and what this means to your world, then this is the podcast for you. Throughout this series, I will be chatting with the thought-provoking, forward-thinking people at the heart of this shift to find out what makes them tick and to explore the sober curious perspective from all angles. And I'll also be giving you oodles of personal tools and tactics to help you get on board the Big Drink Rethink. Welcome, welcome to this special summer edition of the Big Drink Rethink, where I am releasing some of the most downloaded and talked about episodes to help you navigate the season with clarity, curiosity, and choice. This one, my favourite conversation with William Porter, is a favourite for good reason, okay? William is the author of Alcohol Explained, and in this episode we explore why alcohol has become the nation's go-to coping mechanism, what it actually does to our mind and our body, and why the promise it makes of relaxation and connection relief so often backfires. It is especially relevant at this time of year. We head off on summer holidays hoping to rest, hoping to recharge, and yet alcohol often leaves us tired, foggy, anxious, and broken. The very opposite of what we set out to feel. Now, what listeners love about this episode is William's calm clarity, the way he unpacks alcohol's impact on sleep and energy and confidence and mental health, and how that knowledge alone can help us rethink things without pressure or perfectionism. If a fully alcohol-free summer feels like a leap, that's okay. This episode offers a starting point, a way of getting curious, of noticing how alcohol actually makes you feel, and of asking, is it really adding what I hoped for? Or is it taking more than I realised? So, as you listen, you might want to reflect on the following. What do you truly want from this summer? Or from this summer holiday? How is alcohol likely to affect your ability to get it? What might change if you let go of all or nothing thinking? Okay, that is one powerful mindset shift right there, a real perspective changer. Okay, so what do you truly want from this summer holiday? And how does alcohol affect my ability to get it? Those are the key questions. And I'm so glad to be sharing this episode with you again. Welcome to the show, William. It's lovely to be talking to you. I've been looking forward to this a lot.
Hi, Anna. Really nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, no worries at all. Pleasure's all mine. Given your past and mine, I know we're going to chat about a number of things today, but do you want to start off by summarising how an ex-paratrooper and lawyer came to write some pretty seminal books on alcohol?
It won't be a massive surprise to hear. It was neither of those things particularly. The main reason I came to do it was obviously my own drinking, which escalated and escalated and escalated. I started drinking when I was about 14 or so. And we always went out to get drunk. So But we were weekend drinkers. So, you know, Friday would come and we'd go and get as drunk as we could and then do the same Saturday and sort of recover Sunday and back to obviously what was then college, but then became university and then work during the week. And it kind of escalated and escalated. And there were a few particular things that I think increased my drinking. I suppose if you can look back and sort of target the bits where it escalated, one of which was working out that when I because what I would find is when I drank, I would wake up in the middle of the night, you know, your heart beating really fast, unable to get back to sleep, feeling really anxious. And I found that a couple of drinks would send me back to sleep very nicely. So that was kind of a stepping stone in the wrong direction, because you kind of open that door to sort of drinking, falling asleep, waking up and drinking again to get back to sleep. Just before I went out to Iraq, I did 2 months build-up trainings, but it wasn't 2 months solid training. You know, you go off to this base to do this aspect and then have a few days off and then that base to that aspect. And obviously, I was anxious anyway about going out there. And so what I started doing was drinking in the morning. When I was training, I wasn't drinking, obviously, but when I wasn't training, I would wake up feeling nervous, and I sort of found if I had a drink, I felt so much better. Surprise, surprise. So that started me sort of day drinking and morning drinking. When I actually went out to Iraq, it was completely dry. So I did sort of 6 months of not drinking, but came back, and those, what I understand now but didn't quite appreciate at the time, so, well, I'll have 6 months off alcohol, so I'll do kind of a reset and I can go back to normal when I come back. Of course, it doesn't work that way. Whatever level you hit, you very quickly go back there when you start again. So returning from there, my normal drinking would be, I'd start drinking Thursday night, Friday lunchtime, drink through the day, wake up in the night, drink, fall asleep, wake up. So you know, very hard drinking for sort of 48 hours or so. And then the problem then is, as the years go by, you're drinking more and more, and it became more and more likely that I'd start drinking again on a Sunday and then wake up in no fit state for work on a Monday and ring in sick. And then, of course, you're lying there anxious and miserable and you've got nothing to do and you start drinking again. So it was getting more and more out of hand. And then I stopped drinking 10 years ago this February coming. So it was February 14 I stopped drinking, having come out of, I think I'd gone out for a business lunch on the Tuesday, started drinking, rang in sick, carried on. And I think I sort of crawled out the other side of that on a Saturday afternoon, not knowing really what had happened. My wife and kids had left. I hadn't been into work for a week. And that was my last drink. So that's when I stopped. And then fairly shortly after that, actually, so I stopped in February 14. And I think Alcohol Explained was published, first of all, in April 15. So it was, you know, just over a year after that I'd written and published Alcohol Explained.
You've obviously got, you're talking there about a sort of a history of it building and building and building. Mm-hmm. Until, I suppose, what you're describing there about, you know, your wife leaving, the kids leaving, that was a sort of a rock bottom. You know, anyone would describe something like that as a sort of a rock bottom. But still, within all of that, when you were at your lowest, I guess, from an alcohol point of view, you started researching, you were doing work, you were interested. It wasn't a sort of, oh, this has happened to me, you know, I can't do anything about it per se. There was obviously something within you that sparked the interest to sort of really get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the thing, and this is, you know, it might surprise some people to think, well, hang on, you stopped drinking and less than a year later you've written a book. What do you know? Having experienced, you know, a year, and of course anyone who's written a book knows you start writing long before it's published. But what I'd done, you're quite right, I'd been thinking about it and analysing it for years. So by the time I came to stop, I kind of had like 70, 80% of it there. So it wasn't like I stopped and then learned about sobriety. I'd done it for years previously. And what it really was a little bit of science, some fairly basic science mixed in with my own experiences. Because when I started drinking, it was like a sociable thing. I'd be out with friends and we'd be drinking. But in the later years, I didn't want to be around people when I was drinking, because I was drinking to such an extent that I was properly intoxicated, and I was in no state to be around people. And that put me off being around people and drinking, because I just wanted to sit on my own. I didn't want to have to pretend to be sober or to watch what I was drinking. I wanted to be on my own so I could drink as much as I wanted, without having any, you know, having to put on any kind of show or pretend I was sober or watch what I was saying or anything. Spent an awful lot of time just slumped on the sofa in front of the TV, just drunk, really. And I think I was thinking about why I was doing it and sort of picking it apart. And as I say, sort of feeding in a little, you know, some basic science about how our body and brains work and what alcohol is. But really then piecing together, you know, what's going on chemically, physiologically, but most of all psychologically, that makes you keep wanting to go back to it.
No, that makes total sense. And I can really relate to that as well. I think it kind of stacks up, I suppose, to that sense that, you know, I have these days that anyone who finds themselves in that situation, anyone who is finding themselves in a situation where alcohol is taking over or has well and truly taken over, it is incredible what arming yourself with some facts and some understanding can do. Because for many of us, it's the first time that we're kind of digesting some of the science. And, you know, in books like yours, for example, and specifically yours, that science is made really accessible. It's not written by a scientist. It's not written by someone who is there to sort of show off their prowess in the field. It's written by someone who's just trying to work out, whilst also going through their own experiences, what the hell is happening, and why alcohol is effectively working the way it does. Yeah, I think that's so powerful. I mean, I'm a big believer in that whole sort of knowledge is power, and you don't have to scratch too far below the surface of alcohol to start getting the kind of knowledge that makes you think, oh, okay, now that makes sense. I can relate to that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think so. So I'd read a few books on it. I read out, I think, Alan Carr and Jason Vail, and I think they're really good books. I enjoy both of them. But what I was looking for, because both of them say alcohol is addictive, but neither of them really explain how it's addictive. And I never thought of it as addictive because, you know, most drinkers don't drink in the morning. They can drink regularly every evening, but not in the morning. Or you get people like me who drink heavily during the weekends, but then stop during the week. Whereas that wasn't what I thought of as addiction. I would be thinking of cigarettes, where you wake up in the morning and you reach for your cigarettes and you smoke throughout the entire day to bedtime and you go to sleep and then you start again the next day. And to my mind, saying alcohol is addictive, I couldn't even get over that first hurdle. Because I was thinking, well, you have people drinking for decades who don't drink in the morning, who only drink like I was doing. So I drank for like 25 years. And although when I had this, so the reason I didn't drink during the week is because I worked out very early. I couldn't do my job when I'd been drinking the night before. I didn't sleep very well and I couldn't concentrate. And, you know, as a lawyer, you need to be able to get your head around sometimes some quite complicated ideas and concepts. So that was my drinking habit. But I couldn't, you know, I was drinking for 25 years, and even though I was drinking all the time when I was drinking, I would either Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, whatever, come out the other side and sort of sober up for a few days. So I could never really understand, although people said alcohol is addictive, I couldn't quite relate to that.
Yeah, and I think it's also, you know, made more complicated by the fact that there is really no definition of addiction. No. It's really, really personal. You know, I know people who may only drink one glass or two glasses of wine a night, but my God, they have to have them. You know, they're not high volume. Yeah. They're certainly not the sort of stereotypical image of people who are stumbling around and sleeping in skips and, you know, falling in and out of bars and drinking Pernod at 9 o'clock in the morning. They're just people muddling through life, but whose attachment to just those one or two drinks is really quite emotionally strong.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we have views of what somebody who's very, very addicted might look like. But then all of that kind of, we almost have to self-define addiction. And we definitely self-define normality, because we can look at lots of other people and say, well, they're a normal drinker, I'm a normal drinker. If that's how much they drink, then I'm fine. I think it's a lot of grey areas in there, isn't there?
It's a sedative. So something, you know, a depressant, when I use the term depressant, I'm using it in its chemical sense as something that decreases or inhibits nerve activity. And I think most people are kind of on board with that because they think, yeah, okay, I have a couple of drinks and I feel more relaxed. I have too many drinks and I get intoxicated. That's the sedating effect. But where it gets a bit more interesting is when sort of factoring the human brain creates and excretes its own array of chemicals, drugs and hormones. And it's a very complicated process, this, and we don't fully understand it. But what we do know is it works by something called homeostasis, which is a balance of all these chemicals, drugs and hormones. So there's all of these different things in your system all of the time. They wake you up, they put you to sleep, they make you feel happy, sad, excited, whatever it is. But your brain's constantly trying to create this balance. Now, when you introduce something like alcohol, your brain senses, it knows that there's a disturbance to that balance and it tries to counter it. It does it in lots of different ways, one of which it produces more adrenaline and cortisol, which is a stress hormone. But what it's trying to do is counter the sedating effects of the alcohol. So when the alcohol wears off, that oversensitization, that extra stress that it's created to counter the sedating effect of the alcohol remains. And it's a feeling of being like uptight and anxious. And it's why I couldn't sleep at 4 a.m.
I was going to say it explains your manic episodes in the middle of the
night. Yeah, exactly. That insomnia. And of course, there's two ways you can get rid of that unpleasant feeling. One is to just sit and wait for a few days until your brain chemistry gets back to normal. But the far quicker way of getting rid of it is to have another drink. Because what I sometimes liken it to is your brain chemistry is out of whack because it's geared up to work under the sedating effects of alcohol, but the alcohol's gone. So introducing another drink immediately makes you feel a lot better.
So I suppose you're waking up in the night, it's 3 o'clock or it's 3:30, you're having trouble sleeping because you've got adrenaline and cortisol racing around your system. And of course, the sedative nature of a drink can bring it back down. But that adrenaline and cortisol is only there in the first place because of the body's reaction to the alcohol.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's bonkers, isn't it, when you think about it?
I
think sometimes even just being able to have, because I'm quite a visual person, and even being able to have, you know, like kind of like that roller coaster image in my mind, the idea that actually, you know, left to its own devices, our bodies are pretty smart. You know, that homeostasis thing that you're talking about, our ability to, by and large, I mean, not, you know, I know it's this slightly oversimplification, but sort of by and large, the body's pretty good at telling itself where it needs to be and regulating itself. And alcohol is just, I guess, one almighty disruptor.
Really is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. This was the thing. So I got my head around that aspect, and it was like, okay, so that's why I wake up and I can't sleep, and you know, might be absolutely exhausted, but I can't get back to sleep because of all these stimulants in my system. What I kind of realized from my own experience is, aside from what was going on physiologically, that there's psychological things going on, and one of the main ones is it's craving. So I started really analysing craving, because craving is one of those words that we use it and we kind of think of this thing. It's almost like a bolt of lightning that comes out of nowhere and hits us, and oh, I'm craving, and it's deeply unpleasant. But, you know, stopping and really analysing it, I found massively powerful, because you can, it's a conscious thought. And what I found from my own craving, it was very specific. It was like, so the thought of a drink would enter my head, and I would start fantasizing and obsessing about it and almost teasing myself with the thought of it. And I realized this is why I could get through the week quite happily not drinking. But when Friday came, I couldn't. And I might be doing the same thing, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I might be going in, having some dinner and sitting in front of the TV. But when I tried to do it on a Friday, because it was in my, it's Friday, it's drink day. And as soon as you're doing that, you're not concentrating on what's going on. So like Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you know, work's a drag. You get home. It's nice to get home, sit down, have a meal. That is inherently enjoyable. But it's only enjoyable if you're paying attention to it. And if instead of paying attention to the fact that you're relaxing and having a nice meal, you're taken up with this unpleasant internal tantrum, this torture process by, oh, I really want this, why can't I have it? You know, you're not concentrating on the TV or the sitting down and relaxing. So at that point, the alcohol becomes a placebo entirely. It's not the chemical nature of it. It's just, it becomes a huge distraction. But of course, one of the easiest ways to get rid of that distraction is just to have the drink. Because when you're having it, you're not obsessing about it. So when you take the drink, suddenly, oh, I can relax and enjoy sitting on the sofa, having a meal, watching TV, because I'm not being distracted by it. It's exactly what you said before about it's not giving you anything, it's taking. It's taking away your ability to enjoy an inherently enjoyable situation. And then by having the drink, it's then letting you back to enjoying it. And it was kind of a big eye-opener to me, because I realized that's true of holidays and social events and everything. Because when I stopped drinking, it was kind of the mindset that I can't keep doing this. It's completely unmanageable for me, but I'm going to miss out on this huge benefit, this pleasure. And one of the things, for example, was how can I go on holiday and enjoy a holiday without alcohol? But then when you stop and actually think about it rationally, you know, what's enjoyable about a holiday? It's somewhere nice and warm. You get to sit and relax. You don't have the stresses and strains of work. You haven't even got to cook or clean or anything. You know, how can a sedative, something that dulls you, make that more enjoyable?
Yeah, no, I totally get that. And I'm smiling because I used to go, and remember, we spend an awful lot of money on going to the most beautiful places, and they are our most precious times of the year. You know, we have X number of days, use them wisely type thing, and we'd spend an awful lot of money going on holiday, and I would drink solidly. I'd be like, woohoo, school's out. And I would drink solidly such that I, you know, I would come back needing a holiday. I would come back broken. And I would come back probably having enjoyed or maxed out on, you know, a tiny fraction of what that place and what that location had to offer, because my main activity had been drinking throughout. And as you quite rightly point out, anesthetized to some of the stuff that basically is in itself inherently joyful. Literally dumbing and numbing down the experience of being in this lovely place.
So you've got the physical dependency and you've got the psychological dependency. Any drinking requires a degree of dependency, but within society, it's normalized and accepted. See, if I say to a group of people, hands up, who thinks a night out with friends is more fun if you're drinking, everyone puts their hands up, right? It's almost taken as a fact. You have more fun if you're out when you're drinking.
It's subconscious until obviously you raise it to the conscious and you ask a question like that. I mean, I would never have sort of walked around for all those sort of decades that I was drinking, thinking, you know, I must have alcohol. I am dependent on alcohol, and I can only have good fun if I have alcohol. But you're absolutely right. If you'd have said, well, we're all going out tonight and we're not drinking, I'd have been like, there's no point. There's literally no point. I would have stayed in, and, you know, I'd rather stay in and drink than go out and not drink.
Yeah. You see it a lot, sort of particularly around dry January as well. There's, you know, you see people who, so these are people who drink regularly and they give up for January. But to my mind, there's, I was going to say right or wrong way. There's no right or wrong way, but obviously there's a good way, but maybe a better way. But some people are there, and you hear these conversations at work where people say, oh, do you want to come out for a drink tonight? And it's, no, I'm doing dry January. So yes. It's like, I can't imagine socializing without alcohol. So for me, dry January means not socializing. And in a way, you're just feeding into that myth that I cannot socialize without alcohol.
When I coach people and we're talking about that whole alcohol mindset, I do say, let's take a month off. Obviously, it doesn't have to be January. Some people love to do it in January because it's sort of socially, it's more acceptable in January. But ultimately, it's like, we're going to take a month off. But please, 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 please carry on during this month doing everything you would normally do. We're not going to be a hermit for a month, and we're not going to sort of sit at home thinking, what's the point of life? The whole point is to go forth and experience everything you normally do as a comparison without the alcohol, and, you know, see a good night out with friends as being a good night out with friends. Friends are joy. Friends are good company. It's not the alcohol that makes it so. It's the fact that they're your friends. You know, or walk in the country does not have to end in the pub. The walk is nice anyway. It's sort of that sort of thing. And it's really, I think it's really eye-opening when people, you know, do spend that sort of month, as I say, going about their usual business, but going about it without alcohol, that they realize that life doesn't stop. And actually, there are some really lovely pleasures in doing things without alcohol. And my God, they feel better at the end of the month as well, to boot.
That was one of the things I found when I quit, because again, when I quit, I was very much of the opinion, I don't consider myself a particularly extroverted person, and I always struggled a bit interacting with people socially. And so for me, alcohol was always a great thing to have because it helped me kind of relax and socialize. So very much my view was I'm not really going to enjoy social events again. But interestingly, again, delving into kind of the physiological and psychological side of it, when humans, so you've heard of endorphins, I'm sure all your listeners have heard of endorphins. They're a drug that your brain creates and excretes that makes you feel good. And you get endorphins, I kind of think of them as like survival of the species kind of thing, because when you're doing something good for you as an individual or for the survival of the species, you get an endorphin hit. And rather interestingly, we get endorphins when we socialize. So when you are relaxed and socializing and talking to someone, you get an endorphin hit. And I think there's a few really interesting factors there, one of which is when we start drinking, most of us start drinking when we're socializing. And that wonderful feeling we get when we have a few drinks and we're out with friends, we ascribe it to the alcohol, but it's actually a mix between alcohol and endorphins. And the feel-good part of it is the endorphins, not the alcohol. And if anyone's in any doubt about that and you're still drinking, a really fascinating experiment is to take the amount you normally drink and drink it on your own with no music, no TV, no nothing. Just sit in an empty room and drink the alcohol and see if it makes you feel good. And it's a fascinating experience because it doesn't. It makes you feel slightly tunnel vision, slightly confused and disorientated. But it's not a particularly pleasant experience. If you're drinking regularly, there will be an element of relaxation, but that's caused by the previous physiological, you know, that slightly anxious feeling from the previous drinks. But apart from that, there's just that. But what I found really interesting, when I quit, I would go to social events and eventually I would start talking to someone. And as long as you kind of forget what's going on around you and you're interested in the conversation, you get that endorphin hit.
I suppose what's really happening there is we had way less inhibitions. We overthink things when we get older and we start to believe that, yeah, alcohol is our friend in those situations. But I think, you know, what you're really tapping into is we are supposed to be social species. We get highs from being with other people. If you and your experiment sitting on a stool, taking away that stimulus, taking away that connection, you're absolutely right. You know, alcohol is not the same when you don't have those kind of things going on around you. So it's that process of elimination. Take alcohol, put it on one side, and you can see that the experience is completely, you know, completely different. And what we're really enjoying when we're being with friends is being with friends and connecting and laughing and feeling like we belong. One of the things I wanted to just quickly ask you about, because you mentioned a couple of times when you were talking about your drinking and how it was ramping up, was, you know, you were drinking to manage anxiety and nerves. And I just wanted to really, I know it's not a quick subject, it's an incredibly complex subject, but I wanted to talk about mental health and drinking, because, you know, the UK Medical Council describe alcohol as the nation's favorite coping mechanism. And it is astonishing how many of us drink just to manage emotional aspects of our life. And I know sometimes when I talk to younger people and this is the cohort who are drinking less. It is that link between alcohol and mental health that they're making, and they're treating it and approaching it with sort of much more caution. Can you talk from your sort of knowledge and, you know, the ingredients in your book, et cetera, a little bit about that link, about alcohol and using it as a coping mechanism?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a few different threads there, I suppose. One of them is how it affects mental health. Mm. And the other one is using it as a coping mechanism. I'll deal with the mental health aspect first. And I won't go into massive amounts of details. I'm sort of conscious of time, and it's a huge, huge topic.
Sure.
But I've kind of spoken very briefly about how alcohol interrupts that natural brain chemistry. Now, you may have a mental health issue that's due to an imbalancing brain chemistry, and you may need something in order to try and redress that. It's never alcohol. Okay, it can never be alcohol, because whatever perceived benefit you get from a drink, it wears off after 10, 15, 20 minutes, and it causes a swing the other way. So if you're suffering from anxiety and you have a drink, it reduces it and then multiplies it. The other thing alcohol does, it completely stops you from going into a natural sleep cycle. So, you know, a lot of people it's just what we do. You know, we're busy people. We don't have the time and opportunity to learn about everything. So, you know, there's this kind of perception that you drop into bed, you go unconscious for a few hours, and you get up and you're good to go. It's not as simple as that. If you want to wake up physically and mentally refreshed and feeling good and confident and resilient, you need to go through very specific sleep cycles, one of which is REM sleep. REM sleep stands for rapid eye movement, because your eyes move even though your eyes are shut. When they monitor people in REM sleep, their brain lights up almost as if they're fully awake. And it's when we dream. And it's hugely important for our mental health. If you're robbed of REM sleep, you become increasingly depressed and increasingly disorientated. It really is taking a hammer to your mental health to stop yourself going through REM sleep, to say nothing of all the other sleep cycles. Now, I don't know if you've read Why We Sleep by Matt Walker, but Matt Walker is a British scientist working out in America. He's considered by many to be the forefront on sleep and sleep research. And he doesn't even describe what we go through when we drink as sleep. He calls it alcohol-induced unconsciousness, because you're unconscious, but you are not sleeping. Okay, and that's why when you drink, you could be in bed for 8, 10, 12, 14 hours, and you will still wake up feeling exhausted, because you've been unconscious, but you have not been sleeping. And that impact on mental health is huge. I mean, sleep deprivation is used as a form of torture. You know, when people are drinking heavily, there's a massive increase in suicide. It's a direct result not only of messing with the brain chemistry, but being incapable of sleeping. And this is what a lot of people describe as the, you know, like the superpower of sobriety, the best feeling. It's waking up feeling refreshed and happy and ready to go. And you do not get that when you're drinking. And it doesn't matter whether you're drinking at the level I was, a ridiculous amount, or if you're just having one or two, because even one or two drinks completely interrupts your ability to go into those natural sleep cycles. Now, what I quite often hear is, but I need alcohol to go to sleep. I do not sleep without alcohol. And the answer to that is, I don't want to sound arrogant, but it's not true. Because so, like for you and me, Anna, when we go to, we don't drink. So when we get towards bedtime, our brain, you know, I'm talking about that chemical balance, and it can wake you up. It can make you feel excited or happy. And at bedtime, it starts to make you feel sleepy. Your brain releases its own naturally occurring sedatives to make you feel calm and relaxed. And that's why we're always told, you know, good sleep hygiene. Take away the white lights, dim the light, have a nice relaxed atmosphere. It's sending the message to your brain that I am going to go to sleep. And so we then drift into a natural and restorative sleep and wake up feeling good the next day. Now, when you're drinking alcohol, because it is a sedative, your brain stops going through that process, because it doesn't need to go through the process, because it knows that every night at 5, 6, 7, 8, whenever it is, this quite powerful sedative is coming into the system to close things down. So if you're drinking regularly, your brain chemistry changes and your brain stops sending you into a natural sleep because it doesn't need to. It relies on the alcohol. So if you stop on day one, you will be awake for hours. You might not sleep that night. But your brain is great at adapting, and it adapts to alcohol, and it adapts when the alcohol is removed. If you stop drinking, you may not sleep on day one, but your brain very quickly realizes the alcohol is no longer present. So by day 3, 4, 5 or whatever, it picks it up again and you start sleeping normally. Because I even get this from my mum. She's convinced she needs alcohol to sleep. And I'm like, no, you don't. Just stop for long enough.
I think it's, and I guess the thing is as well, because we sort of, we protect alcohol, don't we? If we're drinkers, we sort of protect it. We can sort of not have a drink for a couple of nights. And then because sleep hasn't improved just like that, you kind of go, oh, there you go. There you go.
Perfect.
I'm not sleeping properly now because I'm not having a drink. And it's interesting what you say there, though, William, because it's almost as if it's it equates. I remember when my two daughters were very, very young, and you're sort of teaching them to self-soothe. You have to kind of almost let that natural pattern, that natural chemistry, neurochemistry, I suppose, kick in. Such that they can fall asleep on their own and don't need either the comforter or the hugging or the cuddling and the rocking and the comfort blankets and all the other stuff that we do. It's just allowing the brain to be its natural sedative.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's when you go into that natural sleep and actually wake up feeling refreshed. Yeah.
So alcohol is, again, just that massive disruptor. And of course, you know, the brain being the brain, it says, okay, well, if that alcohol is going to do that job, I can go elsewhere and do other jobs. And it just switches off that
exactly.
natural sedation.
Yeah. It's like I say, it's good at adapting, and it adapts when you introduce alcohol, and it equally adapts when you take it away again. Just to warn people, not to warn them, but just to give a bit more information. If you're drinking regularly, the alcohol never really leaves your system. Alcohol's got a half-life of 5 hours. Okay, what I mean by half-life is it drops to half its level in your body within a five-hour period. So if you're drinking, a few glasses of wine every night, it never actually leaves your system. So your brain's constantly compensating for that alcohol. So it's constantly putting in those extra stimulants to try and counter the alcohol. It's always in your system. So when you finally stop, you will find for the first few days you find it very hard to sleep. But when you get past that, after a few days, the alcohol actually leaves your system and your brain can then stop countering it. What people find is they go the other way. They're always tired. And it's partly the fact these stimulants have been in your system for years and you've now removed them. It's equivalent to drinking loads of strong coffee every day and then cutting it out. You just feel really drained and tired. And partly because you can now sleep properly, your brain's trying to play catch up on sleep. Your brain and body are trying to play catch up on sleep. So what people will find is they'll go through maybe 3 to 5 days of not sleeping very well. And then after that, they'll just want to sleep all the time. They'll be exhausted. But it's when you come out of that that you really start to reap the benefits of not drinking. And as I say, for me, the best feeling is that waking up and thinking, oh, I feel good. I feel ready to start the day. As you just said it yourself, but it was that horrible feeling, the alarm going off and thinking I feel more tired than when I went to bed and I've got a full day in front of me to try and get through. Now, usually if you're tired, you're tired. Or if you're anxious, you're anxious. But alcohol seems to be able to mix the two together. So you're like exhausted and really tired and drained, but also with that residual anxiety. And of course, one very good way to get rid of it is to have another drink, because it anesthetizes. So it takes away the feeling of tiredness. It counteracts that chemical imbalance, which kind of leads us on to the other point, which is why it's used so much as a coping mechanism. And the fact of the matter is, it is a sedative. So if something bad happens to you, it needn't be massive, just the everyday stuff, like a bad day at work or an argument with your partner or a bill you weren't expecting or whatever it is, creates that kind of unpleasant feeling. And because it's a sedative, it will anaesthetize that feeling. So it takes the edge off it. So over the years, it becomes our go-to coping mechanism. But it's a horrendous one as a coping mechanism, because firstly, it wears off awfully quickly and needs another drink to replace it. So having one turns into two and three and more. And then it ruins our sleep. So, if something's troubling you on day one, it's going to trouble you an awful lot more on day two if you haven't slept. So it's worth reminding ourselves that alcohol isn't the only coping mechanism. And what you use as a coping mechanism is going to be deeply personal. So for me, particularly because of my time in the military, I exercise. You know, like going for a run or something, it just makes you feel better. It makes you feel more resilient. I like reading as well, books, whatever. And what you're really looking for is something to take your mind. It's almost like meditation. Meditation is about emptying your mind of all the stresses and strains and giving yourself a bit of a break from them. But you don't need to go through a meditation process. Like reading a book, for me, if it's a good book, I lose what's going on around me and I'm just focused in the story. So even after a particularly bad day, I can lose myself in a book. But it can be anything. It can be, you know, like yoga, knitting, stamp collection, whatever it is. And this is why a lot of people pick up hobbies they had before they started drinking, because drinking comes in and kind of pushes everything else away. But when you stop, you've got a lot more time and headspace to do things. And it's nice to pick up these hobbies, whatever they are. So when you have these bad days, whatever it is, you've got your coping mechanism.
I guess the image that I have in my head of what you're conjuring up for me when you're talking there is this idea that, you know, alcohol is our Swiss Army knife. It's our one tool. It's the thing we use for everything. Mm. If we're drinking to cope, it is our entire toolbox. We need a bigger toolbox. I think it's, you know, it's about thinking about, as you say, deeply personal to different people, but we need different tools, more specific, sharper tools for different things, because then you can, and a lot of the things that you've mentioned, the reading, the meditation, the running, they are the endorphin inducing things that themselves, you know, can give you that really lovely, pleasurable feeling, but only once alcohol is out of the way. But you're absolutely right. You just can't say, you know, alcohol has been your crutch and alcohol has been your tool, but we're going to take that away now. You want to replace it. You've got to replace it with other things. And but I think that's so much of the idea, again, of taking a bit of a break from alcohol and working out what does float your boat. And I love that idea of going back to the things that you used to enjoy, because you don't even have to experiment and find out if you like doing those things. It's about, you know, casting your mind back and thinking, well, before I maybe got myself into a pickle or I got myself into a place where alcohol is everything, what did my life have that I really enjoyed before it got smaller, potentially? I used to think that drinking made me, you know, more happy. It made me happier. It made me more confident, more relaxed, all those more, which meant that it was incredibly hard for me to get my head around the fact that life without alcohol could be anything other than a lesser life, you know. Whereas, you know, it's, I think, you know, the most joyful discovery is that actually, you know, life, when you're drinking, you just fall into settling for a life that is, you know, tiring. You just put it down to, well, this is just life. This is just life. And it's not.
No.
You know, it doesn't have to be that way. And it's when you, as you say, you push through and have a break and then realize that life's just more vivid.
I always think of alcohol explained as like information, and it's giving people information. And it's really up to the individual what they do with that information. So a lot of people use it to stop, other people use it to cut down, or I've no doubt some people ignore it all and carry on as they were, which is entirely their prerogative. It's, you know.
But then that's the point, isn't it? We're all adults and we can do with that information what we want. But at the end of the day, it's really good to have the information so that you're making conscious and informed decisions as opposed to just defaulting to what we've always done. Thank you, William, because ultimately it is because of books like yours that we have that information, because we know for sort of obvious reasons that it's not pouring forth from, you know, necessarily the government or the medical world or, you know, the alcohol drinks world. So, as I've said before on this podcast, it takes individuals like yourself to have really done that groundwork and serve it up for us for the first time. So I'm personally very, very appreciative of that. As I said, Alcohol Explained was a really important resource for me when I was questioning my relationship.
That's
and I
fantastic
think,
to hear. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for asking me.
Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review, and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find out more about the Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebeliefscoach.com. That's thebeliefs, BELIEFS coach.com, where you will see clear links to the show.